तक ऑनलाइन अवेलेबल है.
Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You listen to the sound of universal compassion. Today is 18th of June. We will continue listen to Tenzin's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davis. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome. And further, O bhikkhus. A bhikkhu reflects on just this body, hemmed by the skin and full of manifold impurity, from the soles up and from the top of the hair down, thinking thus. There are in this body hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, fibrous threads, that's veins, nerves, sinews and tendons, bones, marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, pleura, spleen, lungs, contents of stomach, intestines, mesentery, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, solid fat, tars, fat dissolved, saliva, mucus, synovic fluid, urine. So said the Buddha in the Mahasatipatthana Sutra when telling his monk disciples how to overcome attachment to the body. And it ties in nicely with a part of A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life by Indian Buddhist Master Shantideva that we're up to in this series of programs. We're on the chapter on vigilance at the part where Shantideva talks about how to avoid attachment to our body. And last week, we came to the following verses. First of all, mentally separate the layers of skin from the flesh. And then, with the scalpel of discrimination, separate the flesh from the skeletal frame. And having split open even the bones, look right down into the marrow. While examining this, ask yourself, where is its essence? If even when searching with such effort you can apprehend no essence, then why, with so much attachment, are you still guarding this body now? A little later, Shantideva meets the Buddha's description of the lousiness of the body with one of his own. But here, he's talking about trying to actually find what we are so keenly attached to. He tells us to take the body apart, bit by bit, in our mind, with our scalpel of discrimination, even down to the marrow of our bones, to see if we can find an essence, something we can hold on to that makes this body valuable and worthwhile. Attachment to one's physical form, says Pema Chodron, is based on the body being a reliable, continuous entity. But can we pinpoint what we're clinging to when we probe it to its depths? She recommends that, sitting in meditation, you visualize yourself as an infant, and then as a little child just learning to walk. Then picture your body getting older, up to your present age. All that time, has it been the same body? Then go into the future. Your skin becomes slack and wrinkled, your hair thins and turns grey, your teeth are falling out, and your hearing is starting to grow. Keep on visualizing this transformation and decay all the way up to death. And this is what we are so attached to, that we cherish and protect so much. This meditation is, she says, good for giving our attachment a very good shake-up. And then Shantideva, picking up where the Buddha left off, gets all lurid. What use is this body to you if its dirty insides are unfit for you to eat, he asks, if its blood is not fit to drink, and if its intestines are not fit to be sucked? At second best, it is only fit to be guarded in order to feed the vultures and jackals. Truly, this body of a human being should only be employed in the practice of virtue. Now, it's a common Buddhist theme that attachment to the body proves a big obstacle in our quest to free ourselves from suffering. The world, of course, tells us the opposite. Glance at any billboard or TV screen, and you're encouraged, either implicitly or explicitly, to think the body beautiful is what you should be aspiring for. As a consequence, the World Watch Institute claims that women from the USA spend $8 billion on cosmetics a year. And if you add European women in, together they spend $12 billion on perfume alone. As His Holiness says, we see our body as our dearest possession and something to be protected. Though, as I mentioned in the last program, Pema Chodron warns that Westerners also often have a negative relationship with their bodies. In any case, the point of the Shantideva's teachings is that a body is only worthwhile if it's used properly. For, as he asks, but should you instead guard it with attachment, then what will you be able to do when it is stolen by the unsympathetic lord of death and given to the dogs and birds? Once again, he returns to the consideration of death, the inevitable destination of our body. No matter how well we guard and look after it, no matter how many cosmetics we smear on it, or vitamins and minerals we stuff down its throat, or exercise regimes we submit it to, this body will only end up as food for dogs and birds, or in our case, worms. When we drool over the beautiful people, or even over our own magnificent body, it may be useful to remember that not only is the alluring outside package a lie because it hides revolting substances within, but the whole thing is rotting instant by instant, and we nurture it only for it to be a feast for maggots. And on that savory note, let's take a minute to set the motivation for this program as we usually do. As we are contemplating the Bodhisattva's way of life, try to make that your motivation, the wish to attain enlightenment so you can be the best help possible to all others. But if that's too much, at least set the motivation to gain your own liberation. Thank you. Now Shantideva continues his argument, taking a different tack. If servants are not given clothing and so forth, when they are unable to be employed, then why do you exhaust yourself looking after the flesh alone, when even though caring for the body, it goes elsewhere? Now having paid my body its wages, I shall engage it in making my life meaningful. But if my body is of no benefit, then I shall not give it anything. You only give servants clothes and other necessities for as long as they will satisfactorily do the work you set them. If they refuse or cannot work, they get nothing, except maybe the sack. It should be the same for the body, says Shantideva. Why dote so much on it when you know that it's not going to give you long-term service? Only give it its dues while it is useful, but as soon as it can no longer do what you need it to do, stop caring for it. Now, of course, making my life meaningful here means actualizing the Buddha's teachings as far as possible, especially in the development of bodhicitta. Pema Chodron points out that obsessing about how we look and feel wastes precious time and causes us to lose touch with the difficulties of others. I'm reminded of a story about a great Tibetan yogi Milarepa, who I mentioned in an earlier program. He was the one who killed 33 people and then had to build his teacher 9 houses with his bare hands before his teacher would give him any teachings. Anyway, Milarepa spent many years in the mountains meditating with only nettles to make tea as his sustenance. In fact, he drank so much nettle tea over the years that his skin eventually turned green. His clothes rotted off him, and he eventually just lived naked. He duly attained enlightenment in the mountains, and then came down to wander through the country, an old yogi who never wore any clothes and who had a green tinge to his skin. One day, he was sitting on the side of the road when a few young women came by, all made up and looking fine, as young ladies like to be. One of them looked at with distaste at him, and turning to her companion said loudly something like, "Ooh, look at that! I hope I will never be like him." Milarepa glanced up at her and said, "Young lady, you will never be like me." And that is why Shantideva says, "I should conceive of my body as a boat, a mere support for coming and going, and in order to benefit all others, transform it into a wish-fulfilling body." Now, of course, Milarepa was not saying that the young lady could not attain enlightenment. But as long as she was so concerned with her looks and physical appeal, she would never get around to doing what she needs to attain enlightenment. She would always be stuck, primping in this endless samsaric round that promises so much and delivers so little. And the advice is the same for us. Only if we can use our body as a vehicle to create the causes for enlightenment will we be able to transform it into the wish-fulfilling body of a Buddha whose sole intention is to help others. Now, Pema Chodron makes an interesting point here. She says that her teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, often spoke about the importance of respecting the body. From his point of view, eating and dressing well were ways of perking ourselves up and developing confidence in our basic goodness. It's a fine line, however, Pema Chodron writes, between taking pride in our appearance and being obsessed with it. Upliftedness is a way of expressing our human dignity. Obsession is a way of wasting our life. Now I leave you to decide where that line is and what side of it you're on, and go on with Shantideva's next verses, which shows us how to act mindfully to make use of this body. He says, "Now, while there is freedom to act, I should always present a smiling face and cease to frown and look angry. I should be a friend and counsel of the world. I should desist from inconsiderately and noisily moving around chairs and so forth, as well as from violently opening doors. I should always delight in humility. The stork, the cat, and the thief, by moving silently and carefully, accomplish what they desire to do. A bodhisattva, too, should always behave this way. When you walk down the street, watching your reaction to the people you pass, how do the expressions on their faces affect you? Someone smiling at you may be surprising, but don't you almost automatically smile back? At least even a little. And if they glower at you, don't you feel a little bit threatened?" In his novel Vanity Fair, William Makepeace Thackeray wrote, "The world is a looking glass and gives back to every man the reflection of his own face. Frown at it, and it will in turn look sourly upon you. Laugh at it, and with it, and it is a jolly kind companion. And so let all young persons take their choice. And I would say old persons too." Both Thackeray and Shantideva show us that we have a choice here. When he says, "Now while there is freedom to act," intimating that while we have this very favorable human rebirth, Shantideva tells us we have the choice to condition our minds through our faces. We can choose to learn to either turn a friendly eye to all others or let our instinctual growls and gripes rule us. In other situations, other rebirths, we might not have a choice. Like the fiercely territorial tailor ants, we may not be able to do anything but attack any creature that even intrudes on our space. But even now, we may not think so, but what we present on our faces as we go about our daily business makes an impact on the rest of the world, certainly on those people we are in contact with. It's pretty obvious. When someone constantly has a scowl on their face or is always impatient, it certainly makes life a lot more difficult. In a recent example, there was a brouhaha in the Auckland City Council when a senior manager who describes himself as brisk recently made headlines when four managers under him laid complaints against him for bullying. But we can all probably point to someone we work with or are in contact with that evokes an uneasy feeling because a frown or scowl very readily crosses their face. Such a demeanor contradicts the bodhisattva motivation to help others wherever possible, And so Shantideva advises us to try to keep a smiling face turned to the world and always be friendly. Pema Chodron doubts that we can always present a smiling face. But she says a friendly expression makes people more comfortable than frowns and scowls. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama concurs. He says that because we are cultivating bodhicitta, we will want to be a friend to everyone around us, so that what we say will be honest counsel and intended to benefit them. Then the verse on not banging doors or moving furniture about noisily is particularly applicable to how we treat the people that we live with, says Pema Chodron. Not so long ago, a family lived as neighbors to the temple in which I stay. They certainly believed in not being shy when they wanted to express themselves, especially if some strong emotion was involved. Banging doors was the least of it, and I sometimes wondered how people could so easily let the whole neighborhood know when they were excited or hacked off with each other. It made for an ongoing eyebrow-lifting experience, but certainly not a quiet and peaceful one. If we are not always jostling to push our own personal barrow to the fore, so to speak, things will tend to be much more serene. And so Shantideva says it's best to train ourselves to act with humility and consideration. Then he makes a rather strange comparison, to my mind at least. He uses hunters and thieves to indicate how a bodhisattva should go about his or her business. The stork, the cat, and the thief, by moving silently and carefully, accomplish what they desire to do. A bodhisattva, too, should always behave this way. Of course, if a heron and a cat do not move patiently and silently about their business, they will never catch anything to eat. And similarly, a thief won't be able to steal a thing if he proclaims his intentions or presence to the world. These are not great role models for sure, but Shantideva is saying that we have to be as mindful and as focused as these harm givers if we want to be their opposite, an always beneficial bodhisattva. He's not saying that we should go around acting like someone from a nefarious secret society, but that we should take as much care about what we do as a stalking cat, heron, or thief. This means being extra mindful in all our activities. Basically, as His Holiness says, whatever action we do, we have to make sure that we do not disturb others. With respect, I should gratefully accept unsought after words that are of benefit and that wisely advise and admonish me. At all times, I should be the pupil of everyone. Getting feedback is sometimes the only way to discover our blind spots, writes Pema Chodron, especially when that feedback stings. Whether it's meant to be mean or helpful, feedback has a way of getting us to look at things we don't want to see. If we resent it or close our ears, our blind spots will never be revealed. And so Shantideva encourages us to see ourselves as a learner in relation to everyone else. This is common advice in the Bodhisattva teachings, but that doesn't make it any easier to bear when someone says something critical of us. We might still feel the sting, as Pema Chodron puts it, but if we are mindful, we can always be appreciative of what it means for us. Otherwise, we will easily retaliate to the sting and lose the benefit that the meaning of the words can bring us, whether harmfully meant or not. I should say, well said to all those who speak Dharma well, and if I see someone doing good, I should praise him and be well pleased. I should discreetly talk about the good qualities of others and repeat those that others recount. If my own good qualities are spoken about, I should just know and be aware that I have them. All deeds of others are the source of a joy that would be rare, even if it could be bought with money. Therefore, I should be happy in finding this joy in the good things that are done by others. Through doing this, I shall suffer no losses in this life, and in future lives shall find great happiness. But the fault of disliking their good qualities will make me unhappy and miserable, and in future lives I shall find great suffering. In his commentary to these verses, His Holiness says that even if our enemies, never mind our friends, do something good, we should praise them. However, and I don't know if His Holiness was smiling when he said this, if they act under the influence of the eight worldly dharmas, that is, desiring to gain something and hating to lose anything, always seeking pleasure and avoiding pain, wanting fame and disliking disgrace, and always ready to bask in praise but getting angry when blamed, then we don't need to laud them to their face. We can instead say nice things about them behind their backs. In any case, we're not a society that keenly gives credit where it's due, though even a few words of praise can mean an incredible amount and have an effect long after they've been uttered. When I was going through a rough patch as a monastic some years ago, I got a note from someone who I actually thought didn't like me much, saying how much she appreciated me being a monk and how valuable she thought the work I was doing. I'm pretty sure she couldn't have known that I was having a difficult time, and so those few words gave me such a boost and have stayed with me ever since. I think they will probably be with me for the rest of my life. I would not be surprised if the lady who sent the note has now forgotten she even sent it. Anyway, in that situation, I have to be mindful about what Shantideva says about being praised for our own good qualities. The danger is that I could get a bit puffed up or arrogant, maybe thinking, here is some justification to prove that I'm better than others. To avoid such a notion, Shantideva says we should just acknowledge that we may have such qualities and leave it at that. We have to remember that what others think or say about us is inevitably not the whole story. It's only their projection. Even if we do have good qualities, they're sometimes offset or polluted by secret intentions, some of which we don't even admit to ourselves. So we have no cause to elevate ourselves just because of another person's words. Pema Chodron points out that rejoicing in the good qualities of others takes us out of our self-centeredness and expands our view of the world. It's a way of creating virtue, she says, that helps both ourselves and others. And she also points out to how we often have difficulty accepting compliments, even though we can also create virtue if we accept praise in a gracious, down-to-earth way. We don't need to poo-poo others' good opinion of our actions or let our self-cherishing mind balloon us into something that we're not. To coin a cliche within a cliche, if I had a dollar for every time I've said that we all want happiness and don't want suffering, I would now be a rich man. But Shantideva tells me that no matter how rich I was, I would have difficulty buying the happiness that comes from rejoicing at the good deeds of others. We normally look for happiness where it is actually not to be found. Pema Chodron uses the example of overindulging in various substances and telling people off because it feels good to set them straight. Instead of increasing our well-being, though, she says, we strengthen the very qualities that cause our suffering. Because of this, we very rarely create the causes for real happiness. Rejoicing in others' good qualities is not only an antidote for envy, but it also generates warmth and brings us heartfelt joy. She writes, when we begin to appreciate the kindness and courage of others, we find pleasure everywhere. Zigar Kontrol calls this rejoicement therapy. The happiness we experience in cultivating an attitude of rejoicing in others' good qualities will not only enrich us in this life, says Shantideva, but the habit, carrying into other lives, will bring us enduring happiness in those lives as well. Similarly, if we cultivate habits of moroseness and criticism, this life will be difficult, and carrying those habits into future lives, we will fill those with problems and misery as well. Then Shantideva goes on to talk about speaking mindfully. He says, when talking, I should speak from my heart and on what is relevant, making the meaning clear and the speech pleasing. I should not speak out of desire or hatred, but in gentle tones and in moderation. Pema Chodron has some enlightening things to say about this verse when she writes, mindful speech can be one of the most difficult practices. To speak honestly and coherently is hard enough, but to speak with moderation is an even greater challenge. Trungpa Rinpoche put great effort into having his students speak slowly, mindfully, and clearly. This was a rewarding and illuminating practice. Slowing down our speech can have a remarkably calming effect. It can also make us nervous. We are so used to mindlessness and speed that slowing down can feel threatening. Shantideva encourages us to speak gently and without bias. It can be embarrassing to see how much prejudice we convey with our words. Acknowledging biased mind before it turns into speech can spare us a lot of pain. Without justification or guilt, praise or blame, we can recognize we're getting caught and keep silent. Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese master, rewrote the five precepts for a modern age in his book Peace is Every Breath, and this is what he has to say about loving speech and deep listening. Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others, I am committed to cultivating loving speech and compassionate listening in order to relieve suffering and to promote reconciliation and peace in myself and among other people, ethnic and religious groups and nations. Knowing that words can create happiness or suffering, I am committed to speaking truthfully, using words that inspire confidence, joy, and hope. When anger is manifesting in me, I am determined not to speak. I will practice mindful breathing and walking in order to recognize and to look deeply into my anger. I know that the roots of anger can be found in my wrong perceptions and lack of understanding of the suffering in myself and in the other person. I will speak and listen in a way that can help myself and the other person to transform suffering and see the way out of difficult situations. I am determined to not spread news that I do not know to be certain and not to utter words that can cause division or discord. I will practice right diligence to nourish my capacity for understanding, love, joy, and inclusiveness, and gradually transform anger, violence, and fear that lie deep in my consciousness. Now, isn't that a wonderful way to approach the practice of mindful speech? Not only thinking about the words that we say, but also about how we listen. So much of the time we filter what people say to us through our own preconceptions and attitudes. We don't take the time to actually stop and pay full attention to what is really being conveyed to us. Or we just don't listen at all. Acting like this, how can we even think of being of help to others? His Holiness often says that we cannot exist without the kindness of others. Everything we do, everything we enjoy, depends on the kindness of others. For instance, the vegetables we eat have come from the kindness of those who planted and nurtured them, those who have harvested them, those who transported them, and those who put them in the shop for us to buy. We even owe a debt of gratitude to the worms that aerate the soil in which the veggies grow. But this is true of everything in our lives. Try to think of one thing that you use or enjoy that does not depend on the industry and kindness of others. I think you won't be able to. But even more important, we depend on others to attain enlightenment and a complete freedom from suffering. If there were no others, if you were the only being on earth, not only would you find it extremely difficult to exist, but you would have no chance of making progress on the spiritual path. And so Shantideva says, when beholding someone with my eyes, thinking, I shall fully awaken through depending on this being, I should look at him with an open heart and love. Realizing that every being is our passport to nirvana, how can we not look at all beings with a warm and grateful heart? We'll talk about more about this next time, but please now dedicate any positive energy from our session today to your purpose, particularly gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you, and I hope you'll join us again next week. Goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering.